Okay, 2 Kings chapter number 9. I was looking today, and it's been since the middle of January whenever we talked about Ahab. Because we got, after Ahab, we were looking at Elijah and Elisha, and that took up several weeks. And then we went to Judah, to the southern kingdom, and we talked about Jehoshaphat, which was a good king. So we had Jehoshaphat, and then after Jehoshaphat, we had who? Jehoshaphat was the good king. Nobody remembers? Some are looking in Chronicles to find out. Okay, you had Jehoram and Ahaziah, right? Yeah, Jehoram and Ahaziah, which was Jehoshaphat's son that married Athaliah. And then Ahaziah, which was Jehoshaphat or Jehoram and Athaliah's son.
Yeah.
And then after Ahaziah died, then you had Athaliah, which was Jezebel's daughter, right? And so that's what we've been looking at. And so now we got to go back and look at what happened in the northern kingdom after Ahab died, right? And so after Ahab died, his son took over as king. And then he fell down through the lattice of his roof and went to call on the false gods to figure out if he was going to live or die, right?
Yeah.
And Elijah gave him the message that he was going to die.
Right.
And he did. And then his son took over, right? No, his brother took over. Then his brother took over, which was Ahab's other son, and reigned for a good while. And he was the one that Jehoshaphat kept getting in trouble with. Right? Trying to make alliances with him. And then he's also the one that Ahaziah, which was Jehoshaphat's grandson, right, was with whenever he ended up getting killed by Jehu, which is what we're going to look at today, right? And so Joshua, not Joshua, I say Joshua, 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 1, says, "And Elisha the prophet called one of the children of the prophets and said unto him, Gird up thy loins and take this box of oil in thine hand and go to Ramoth Gilead. And when thou comest thither, look out there Jehu the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him arise from among his brethren and carry him to an inner chamber. Then take a box of oil and pour it on his head and say, Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then open the door and flee and tarry not. So the young man, even the young man, the prophet, went to Ramoth Gilead. And when he came, behold, the captains of the host were sitting. And he said, I have an errand to thee, O captain. And Jehu said, Unto which of all us? And he said, To thee, O captain. And he arose and went into the house and poured the oil on his head and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I have anointed thee king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. And thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab him that pisseth against the wall, and him that is shut up and left in Israel. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. And the dog shall eat Jezebel in the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. And he opened the door and fled. Then Jehu came forth to the servants of his lord, and one said unto him, Is all well? Wherefore came this mad fellow to thee? And he said unto them, Ye know the man, and his communication. And they said, it is false. Tell us now. And he said, thus and thus spake he to me, saying, thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. And they hasted and took every man his garment and put it under him on top of the stairs and blew the trumpet, saying, Jehu is king. So this is Jehu that we were first introduced to back in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 16, whenever God was talking to Elijah in the cave. Remember, Elijah had depressed in the cave, and he said, I'm not done with you yet. I've got jobs for you to do. Go anoint Jehu, Hazael to be king over Syria, and Elisha to be prophet in your room, right? Mm-hmm. And the only one that Elijah actually anointed was Elisha, right? Okay. And so Elisha sent and anointed Hazael. I think he sent someone to do it. And then here he sends somebody to anoint Jehu. And so Elijah is going now, and now Elisha is sending this prophet, or yeah, this son of the prophets to go and anoint Jehu to be the king. And what was the promise that Elijah made, or that God made to Elijah about these three that would be anointed? You want to remember? What was Elijah upset about? Okay. He was the only one left serving God. Everyone else was serving Baal, right? He just got done with a showdown on Mount Carmel. Said, I'm the only one left, and my ministry has been a flop, and I've been completely unsuccessful. It's a lost cause. And so God says, anoint these three, and they are going to finish what you started. It's not that you have failed. It's that you have begun something that is going to be continuing and finishing after you are gone. And that whoever is left of Elisha, Hazael would get, and whoever is left of Hazael, Jehu would get, right? Or in some such order. And basically through all of those, God was going to judge Israel, and he was going to get rid of Baal worship within Israel. Even though it wasn't going to happen in Elijah's time, it was something that Elijah started that would be finished. And so that promise was back in 1 Kings 19. And so anyway, whenever Elisha sends this prophet, he goes to anoint Jehu. Jehu is having a meeting, a get-together, whatever, with the other captains. Jehu is one of the captains of Ahab's army, right? It's not Ahab anymore, it's Ahab's son. But he's captain over the army. He is a high-ranking military official. And the prophet comes and says, I need to speak to you privately. Goes and speaks to him privately. They come back out, and the guy just runs off. And one of the soldiers looks at Jehu and says, what did the crazy guy want? Call him a mad fella, right? He says, what did the crazy guy want? Jehu doesn't just come out and say it. They have to pull it out of him. He says, oh, you know what he was wanting. They're like, no, we really don't. Tell us. And so he says, he anointed me to be the king. I said here last week, I think, that Jehu was the only northern king that was actually anointed by a servant of God. You look at all the rest of them, they either got there through treachery, they inherited it from their father, they stole it from somebody else by committing a coup and committing treason, right? But Jehu is the only of the northern kings that was actually anointed by God. And with that, do you think he's going to be a good king or a bad king? Okay, so somewhat of a trick question. There was no good kings in Israel, so by default, he's got to be a bad king, right? But he was anointed of God, he was given a task by God, and he carries out that task. So why wasn't he a good king? Do what? He pretty much did. We'll get to it here in a minute, but he gathered all the prophets of Baal and all the worshipers of Baal in the temple, and then brought his soldiers in and killed every one of them. right?
Well, he destroyed Baal, but he didn't destroy the golden calves.
Okay, so he still followed in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, right?
He didn't follow God.
Okay. See, he may have been the leader over God's people, but God never had his heart. That was what the biggest thing is. Whenever God came and anointed him, said, hey, you're going to be king. You're going to avenge the house of Ahab for the wickedness and because of the Baal worship and all of this. He says, yeah, promotion, right? I get to become king. God tells me to kill people. I'm a soldier. I like killing people. I can go do that. And so he's happy to do it. And not only is he happy to do it, he takes it to an extreme. He takes his job that was given to him by God, and he takes it to an extreme end and goes beyond anything that God ever told him because, honestly, that was just what he liked to do. And what we find in this is just because God uses someone doesn't mean that they are of God or know God, right? This goes back to what I was talking about in Sunday school a couple weeks ago when we were talking about context and talking about interpreting scripture and things because I'm trying to remember what it was we were exactly talking about, but it was whenever Gamaliel, I think it was saying, just leave the Christians alone, and if it's not of God, then it'll come to naught. Remember I was talking about that? And a lot of people think that that's good advice. It didn't come from a Christian, and it's not good advice to go by because success is not the determining factor of whether something's of God or not, right? There are plenty of prophets in the Bible, plenty of servants of God in the Bible that wouldn't be considered successful by worldly standards, right? And so just because Jehu was used of God, just because he carried out some of the acts of what God would have him to do, doesn't mean that he was actually serving God or pleasing God. God can actually use even wicked people to bring about his purposes and his will. We see it done in politics all the time. You get countries that God allows for wicked rulers to come in to chasten the people, right? It happened all throughout the Bible that God would allow the wicked to come in and chasten the people. That's the gist of the entire book of Habakkuk. If you read through Habakkuk, he is saying, the people of Israel are wicked, God. How long are you going to let them do this? And God says, it's okay. I've got it under control. I'm going to bring in the Assyrians or someone in to punish them. And then Habakkuk says, how can you use someone more wicked than they are to punish them for their wickedness? Right? And so this is kind of what's going on is you got wicked King Ahab, and God is going to use wicked King Jehu to take care of wicked King Ahab. And so God can work all things together for good, even whenever it's something like the craziness of Ahab or the craziness of Jehu. And so what we see here is it's told him that he's going to smite the house of Ahab, his master. He's going to get rid of all of Ahab's family, every last one of them. That was prophesied to Ahab back because of the wickedness that he had done. Elisha, I believe it was, or Elijah came to him and told him that his entire family is going to be cut off. And then he kind of whimpered and blubbered around a little bit and was sad because of it. And God says, well, because he showed some remorse, I'm not going to make it happen in his lifetime, but it will happen in his children's lifetime. And so Ahab still ends up dying on the battlefield. Stray arrow. Right? Stray bullet. Gets him. And so he's still going to die on the battlefield, but it's going to be his children that's going to end up falling to all these things that was told him. And so whenever Jehu hears this, he tells all of the soldiers that he is over, and they say, hey, we know it was a prophet. We know he was anointed. We don't care too much for Ahab's dynasty. So Jehu's king. And so Jehu has become king by virtue of the Lord's anointing and of the military's blessing, right? And so that is a good way to gain power. If you have God and the military behind you, then you're good and you're set, right? And so what he's going to do, and I won't read it all, but what he ends up doing is he starts making his way to where Ahab's son Jehoram is at. Jehoram had went to battle with the Syrians. Remember, that was part of the prophecy to Elijah, is that the Syrians would avenge Elijah of Ahab's household, right? And so Jehoram, the son of Ahab, had gotten injured in battle. He had come back to be healed in Jezreel, it says in verse 15. And he was recovering, and Ahaziah, the king of Judah, had heard that he'd got injured, heard that he was in Jezreel and was trying to recover. And so Ahaziah came to comfort him and talk with him because Ahaziah was his nephew, right? His mom was Jehoram's sister. And so he's coming and visiting Uncle Jehoram and checking up on him to see how he's doing, completely unaware of the fact that the military has just accepted Jehu as king and that Jehu's been anointed as king. And Jehu is on his way to where Jehoram is. And so as he is coming, Jehoram looks out, sees that there's someone coming, and so he sends a messenger. Says, okay, that's a military chariot. They're bringing back word from the battle. Let us know how we're doing, how the army's performing. Go and bring word back. The military, or the messenger, gets to Jehu and says, what's going on? And he says, join in with me. So he joins in behind him. He just follows him. And so anyway, finally, Jehoram says, okay, the messengers aren't coming back. And someone reports to him and says, I can tell by the way he's driving, it's Jehu. And so Jehoram says, well, I'm going to get in my chariot and go out and meet him. So I don't know if his thoughts was, Jehu is my military man, he is someone dependable, I can go out and join in with him, I can go out and talk with him, or I'm going to get my chariot just in case I need to escape. One way or the other, he was mobilizing. He's like, I'm not just going to sit here in the city and wait till he gets here. And so whenever he goes out to meet him, he says, is it well? And he says, it can't be well as long as you, the son of a murderous woman, Jezebel, is on the throne. And Jehoram says, uh-oh. Right? We're in trouble. And so he tries to get away. He turns his chariot around. And Jehu draws his bow back at full strength, lets go of the arrow, and it goes directly through Jehoram's heart. And it just so happens that the place that they are at is right at the property that belonged to Naboth, the vineyard that belonged to Naboth, that Ahab had killed Naboth and stole his vineyard. And part of the reason why the punishment was coming upon Ahab and his household was because of what he had done to Naboth. So Jehoram dies and is cast out of his chariot in Naboth's property to where the blood is going to go into the ground in Naboth's field that was stolen by killing the owner, right? Just like it was prophesied. And we see that down in verse number 21. Met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. And then you go down in verse 26. Surely I have seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, saith the Lord, and I will requite thee in this plot, saith the Lord. Now therefore take and cast him in the plot of ground according to the word of the Lord. And so now Ahab's son that was reigning is dead. But you've got Ahaziah, the king of Judah, is there, but he is part of Ahab's family now, right? Married in. And so Jehu says, hey, he is related to him, guilt by association. I'm supposed to kill all of Ahab's family, and he's got Ahab's blood in him. So then he kills the king of Judah as well. So he kills two kings at the same time, basically. Shoots Ahaziah. Ahaziah's going, and he proceeds to go forth into the city where Jehoram just came out of, and Jehoram's mom, Jezebel, is there. We know the story of that, right? He comes, and Jezebel sees him coming, knows what's happened, knows he just killed her son, and doesn't seem like she even cares. But it says that she goes and she gets her makeup and her hair done and gets ready for Jehu. Maybe she's thinking that she can make an alliance with him. Maybe she's thinking she can seduce him. I don't know how old she is by now, but she's got two sons that were kings, right? But anyway, so she leans out the window and she says, "Did it go well for Zimri that killed his master?" Because Zimri was the one that came in and slew the king, took his place as king, went through, killed all of the family, and then after 7 days committed suicide. So he's king for 7 days. He says, "So," or she says, "So did it go well for Zimri?" Insinuating that just like you kill, or just like Zimri killed the king, now you killed the king, you're going to suffer the same fate as what he did. You're going to be unsuccessful. Maybe she's even encouraging him. You might as well just go ahead and kill yourself. I don't know. And so anyway, he doesn't pay much attention to her. He calls out into the tower where she's at and says, "Who's on my side? Who's with me?" And there's a few eunuchs that lean their head out. They got tired of taking Jezebel's orders and living amongst Jezebel. I can't imagine that she would be a real good employer. Can you imagine working for Jezebel? And so Jehu hollers up and says, "Who's on my side?" They look out and say, "We are. We don't like her either." And he says, "Throw her out." They cast her out of the tower. She splatters on the ground. The blood soaks against the walls. And Jehu proceeds to ride his horse and chariot back and forth over top of Jezebel until she's gone. Nice gory end for Jezebel. That's a suiting end, isn't it? Okay. And so anyway, after he does that, he's made king. He has taken over the palace. So what's the first thing that a bloodthirsty ruler is going to do? First thing he's going to do on his job, he goes inside and gets a sandwich. It's good to be king. He's going in and he's making himself at home. So he goes in, and verse 34, when he was come in, he did eat and drink. Now, sandwiches may not have been invented back then, but that's what I picture. He goes in and the eunuchs just threw her out, and he's like, "Okay, guys, I took care of the crazy boss. How about you make me some food?" They're like, "Gladly, here you go." And he's sitting there eating, and about the time he gets done, he's picking the stuff out from between his teeth. And he's like, "You know what? She was the daughter of a king. We probably ought to give her a proper burial." He goes outside, and all the wild dogs of the city have already came and ate her body, leaving only the palms of her hands, soles of her feet, and her skull. Everything else is gone. Now, not to be too gory, or maybe to be a little gory, just the fact that it was only her skull, her hands, her feet, leads me to believe that more than likely the rest of the bones of her body were so broken from him trampling her that there wasn't a whole lot left. The dogs were able to eat them, right? Because I couldn't imagine, you know, like a femur would still be left over unless it was just broken so badly. That gives you an idea of what happened, right? But I've always thought that the reason why it mentions that her head, her hands, and her feet were left over was her wicked mind, her soiled hands, and the feet that ran to shed innocent blood, right? So it's almost symbolic, and there's a reason why it was in the scriptures, and I believe that's why. Her hands did the work, her feet carried her there, and her head thought it up. And so those were the parts not even the dogs would touch. And so after all that's done, this is fulfilling the prophecy. It says that the dogs would eat his family, right? The dogs ate his family. Probably the same thing happened to Jehoram whenever he was through in Naboth's field. And Jehu's on this high. He feels as if he is the avenger of the Lord. He is the Lord's enforcer. He is the one going and setting all the wrongs right. Okay? He's cleaning house. But it's getting to his head as well. He's not seeing himself necessarily as God's servant so much. But in his arrogance and in his pride, he is taking it upon himself to go above and beyond what God has told him to do. We'll see that here in a minute. But in chapter number 10, he goes out to Samaria. Remember, they've been in Jezreel. He goes to Samaria. That's the capital city of Israel. And whenever he gets there, there is I guess it would be the actual palace complex. Jezreel would be like the summer home. Okay? So he goes to the actual palace complex where all of the king's family was living. And he had 70 children that lived in Samaria. And they were left with their tutors, with the people that was in charge of bringing them up, of raising them, of teaching them, of rearing them. And whenever he comes to the city, he is coming with his army, right? Because he's a military man. And it's already been made known what he's done in Jezreel, and that he's already killed two kings and Jezebel, right? And so then it says in chapter 10, Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. So Jehu wrote letters. I said that he went to Samaria. He didn't go to Samaria. He was still at Jezreel. He wrote letters and he sent them to Samaria. And he let them know that he was now in charge, that he was now the king. And he says, since you're over Ahab's household, set up a king. Make one of them king. Bring him out against me. Let's see who's going to win. And the men who was in charge, the ones who was raising up Ahab's children, sent back and says, we're not going to make anyone a king. We're going to submit to you. Do whatever you think is best. So Jehu sends another letter and he says, okay, then if you're going to do whatever I tell you, verse number 6, he wrote a letter the second time to them saying, if you be mine and if you will hearken unto my voice, take ye the heads of the men of your master's sons and come to me to Jezreel by tomorrow this time. Now the king's sons, being 70 persons, were with the great men of the city, which brought them up. Okay, so what's Jehu's message to the people at Samaria? Is that what he said?
Bring all of them alive so that
they can
kill them.
Okay. See, Jehu is doing something sneaky here. Because what we're going to find out about Jehu is Jehu was a politician through and through. Okay? Politicians are known for being manipulative, for being subtle, for being tricky and treacherous, for being conniving, right? And Jehu was. So whenever he says in verse number 6, take ye the heads of the men, your master's sons, and come to me in Jezreel tomorrow. The heads means, it can mean two different things, right? Either literally take their heads and bring them to me, or the heads are the ones who are in charge. So it was up to the readers to interpret what Jehu meant, right? So whenever Jehu says, bring the heads of the sons to me, it could mean bring the leaders, bring those who are in charge. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk about this. Or decapitate them and bring me their heads. It was up to them to interpret it one way or the other, right? And so they interpreted it the second way. They decapitated all of them and brought him 70 heads to Jezreel. Brought them in baskets, and he says, okay, set them at the gate of the city, make two piles of heads. Now, wouldn't that send a message to all of Jehu's enemies? Anyone who would oppose Jehu, look at the pile of heads, right? But we go down to verse number 10. Know now that there shall fall unto the earth nothing that the word of the Lord, which the Lord spake concerning the house of Ahab, for the Lord hath done that which he spake by his servant Elijah. And so he said, look, this is the fulfillment of the prophecy. Not a word of the Lord is going to go undone, right? Unperformed. But what he does with the people who came in verse number 9, I meant to read it first. In verse number 9, it came to pass on the morning that he went out and stood and said to all the people, "Ye be righteous, behold, I conspired against my master and slew him, but who slew all of these? Know now that there shall fall into the verse I just read." So whenever he comes out, he's got the two heaps of heads. He comes out and he says, "Yeah, I killed Jehoram, but I haven't left Jezreel. I haven't left this place. So it couldn't have been me that killed all of these 70 sons of Ahab. That's on you." Right? Essentially what he does right here is he's like Pilate, washing his hands in front of all of them. "I'm innocent. I haven't touched them. I didn't do it. They did it. They brought them." You say, "Well, look at your letter. It says bring their heads." "No, I meant to bring the ones that was in charge. Bring the authorities. You're the ones that brought their heads." He's a politician. He's not taking responsibility. He's going through all of these things, trying to make himself look good, trying to make himself look righteous. And at the end of verse number 10, what I just read there a minute ago, was whenever he says, "The Lord hath done that which he spake concerning his servant Elijah." Do you notice what Jehu is doing with that? He is associating himself with the Lord and with Elijah. And there couldn't be any bigger difference, I don't think, between Jehu and the two that he was trying to group himself together with. He says, "Hey, I'm with them. He prophesied it. He demanded it. And I performed it. And so we're the little trinity of retribution here." He's a politician. He's setting himself up. He's making himself big. He's making himself as if he is the avenger of God. And so anyway, he continues in verse 12. "He arose and departed." No, verse 11. So Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel. So that was what God told him to do. Chapter 9, verse 7. "Thou shalt smite all the house of Ahab." So verse 11. "Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel." And that's whenever we start going beyond what God told him to do, right? "And all his great men," that would be his advisors, that would be the people that could have been good counselors to Jehu, he goes ahead and kills them too. "And his kinfolk," anyone even remotely related to him, "and his priests, until he left none remaining. And he arose and departed and came to Samaria. And as he was at the shearing, in the way, Jehu met the brethren of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and said, 'Who are ye?' And they answered, 'We are the brethren of Ahaziah,'" which Jehu has just killed, right? And so Jehu kills all of them. So now he's not just killing wicked Ahab's family, he's now killing people in the Davidic kingdom. Okay? Descendants of King David over Judah. He's crossed the line. "So he took them alive at first, then they slew him and threw him in a pit at the shearing house, even 42 men. So are we keeping a body count so far? We have Jehoram, Ahaziah, Jezebel, there's three, 70 sons. Then the priests and the kinsfolk and the advisors, it doesn't give a number. Now we've got 42 more. So without the priests and all of those, we're already up almost 150. So we're over 200 guaranteed, right? So he's a mass murderer. And he's going way above and beyond what God has told him to do. And what it makes me think of whenever he's doing this is God gave him one thing to do. Then he takes it upon himself to go above and beyond God's word and pretend like he is righteous in doing so. How would that apply to us today as Christians? Does it? Was Jehu not doing the exact same thing as the Pharisees did in the New Testament? Taking the commands of God and going beyond them? And acting as if they had God's authority and they were doing God a favor? Causing hurt and hardship and pain and mess everywhere they went? So basically it's the same idea, right? And if we're not careful, in our pride and in our self-will, just like the Pharisees, just like Jehu, we take the things of God, and then we add to our own preferences, our own desires, and pat ourselves on the back and think that we're doing God's will. And instead, we are oppressing, we are hurting, we're causing trouble, we're going above and beyond what God ever said to do, right? And so we need to make sure that whenever we are doing things, and when we're thinking things, and when we're teaching things, and whenever that it is actually in line with God's word, and not us taking liberties with it and going beyond what's scriptural. Right? Just for our own pride or selfish will. And so whenever we come down to verse number 15, we are introduced to another fellow. As Jehu is riding along on his little vengeful bloodbath, he comes across Jehonadab, which doesn't realize what danger that he is in coming in contact with such a bloodthirsty mass murderer. But whenever he comes to Jehonadab, he is actually, Jehonadab is a, he's a good guy, okay? They are part of the Rechabites. We can read about them in Jeremiah 35. They were people that kind of separated themselves and just kind of lived by themselves outside of Israel, that kept the law, that had very strict kind of ascetic life and everything. They were well-respected by the Jews, okay? They were seen as very, very pious people. They were seen as people who were very committed to God, but they didn't really mix with all the rest of the mess. They just kind of kept to themselves and served God, okay? And so they were seen as being honorable. In Jeremiah 35, what it talks about is where they basically had been told from their father all the way down for them to not to drink wine and not to do these different things. And they continued that lifestyle. They didn't break it, and they were praised for it. And at that time, the leaders in Israel were trying to get them to violate their conscience, and they refused to do it. And they were being praised because they were keeping the commandment of a man, their father, whenever the people of Israel wouldn't even keep the commandments of God. Okay, saying that the Rechabites were more honorable because they took more seriously the commandments of just their father than what Israel did, God the Father. Okay, so the Rechabites were a good people. They were an honorable people. They were well looked at by the Israelites and by God. And now they come across Jehu. Okay, so Jehonadab comes and Jehu salutes him and says, "Is thy heart right as my heart is right?" Is Jehu's heart right? No. I mean, how do you just murder that many people with a smile on your face and come and say, "Hey, I'm just servant of the Lord"? And so Jehonadab answered, "It is." And so Jehu says, "If it be, give me thine hand." And he gave him his hand and took him up into his chariot. Verse 16, and he said, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord." So he made him ride in his chariot. So now we're getting a peek into Jehu's mind. He says, "Come, let me show you how godly I am. Let me show you my zeal for the Lord." And what is his zeal for the Lord? This is where they go to the Baal temple, call all the prophets of Baal, all the people that worship Baal. We're going to have a huge sacrifice. He says, "Ahab served God or served Baal a little. I'm going to serve him a lot. Send out the word, send it out through all of Israel, bring all the people in here to this temple, and we are going to worship Baal. We're going to have just this great big sacrifice." And so everybody's pouring in and they're excited. The new king is a Baal worshiper, and he's going to worship him much. He's going to make a big sacrifice. And they all gather in the temple, And he says, okay, look around and make sure that there's no servants of the Lord here. We only want Baal worshipers here. And so they make sure that there is no godly people amongst all of them. And they go ahead and they proceed with the sacrifice. And as soon as the sacrifice is over, he sends the signal to the leader of his military men. And they come in and slaughter everyone. Doesn't leave a single one of them left behind of all the prophets of Baal. So now we are, who knows how many thousand people in, right? He has a high kill count, a body count. But anyway, we're a little bit torn because of this. They're the worshipers of Baal, right? He is the anointed king. He is in a place of authority. He has the right to bring about justice and promote righteousness and to judge those who are against God. He has the right to do that, right? But this is another time where you do the right thing the wrong way. It's hard to think of killing all of the prophets of Baal, killing people, as being the right thing, but it was a judgment, and he was a divine authority to bring about judgment on those people. They weren't innocent. Ahaziah, he was innocent. Ahaziah's family, the 40-some guys, they were innocent. Ahab's family wasn't. The Baal worshipers weren't. But how did he go about doing this? He's the king. He has the authority. He could have shut down the temple, made a decree, said that Baal worship is out, and then brought each and every one of them to justice, executed them, do whatever. But he resulted to deceit, lies, right? And so what he did the right thing. He went the wrong way about doing it. And with him being a king, with him being God's representative, it's that much more important that he does the right thing the right way. But whenever it says in verse number 19, about halfway through, it says, but Jehu did it in subtlety. Now, whenever you hear that word subtlety, what does it make you think of? Okay. And none of those things align with God and with the way that he does things, right? Who does it align with? Okay. So you look at Genesis chapter 3 and verse number 1. What does it say? Now the serpent was more subtle than all the beasts of the field, and it was a serpent in his subtlety that he tricked Eve. Deceit, right? And so Jehu was operating by Satan's systems, by the way that Satan, he's operating out Satan's playbook to bring about the end of Baal worship. Being the king, he could have came out and he could have judged them as a king, but instead he tricked them as the serpent. And so what he did here was just a type of extreme pragmatism. The end justifies the means. Doesn't matter how we did it as long as we got it done. And that's what he was doing. We've got to be careful and make sure that we're not trying to do the right thing the wrong way. We're not trying to serve the Lord in a way that does not align with the things of God, right? And so lies and deception is not the way to go about it. So anyway, that took care of all of that was going on with the prophets of Baal. And we come down to verse number 30, and it says, and the Lord said, verse 30 of chapter 10, and the Lord said unto Jehu, because thou hast done well in executing that which is right in mine eyes, and hast done unto the house of Ahab according to all that was in mine heart, thy children of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. But Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart, for he departed not from the sins of Jeroboam, which made Israel to sin. So God gave him an opportunity. He says, I put you here. I'm letting you judge. I'm going to give you four generations. God's done all this for him, but he doesn't care. He doesn't serve God. He cares about Jehu. He cares about his legacy. He cares about doing what he wants to do. Look at my zeal. Look at what I'm going to accomplish. And he does have a long reign. He reigns for 28 years, but he does it all for self, for his own glory, for his own pride, for his own ego. And all four of his sons, the four his son, grandson, great-grandson, great-grandson, four generations, every single one of them wicked. Okay? And really, we could go through and look at each one, but there's not a whole lot said about any of them. There was nothing remarkable about them. They didn't do anything that great, except for Jeroboam II. God had mercy on the people of Israel and gave them respite from the Syrians and allowed Jeroboam II to have some victories, to regain some land and have a long kingdom, but not because he was good, but because God was merciful on Israel. Okay? So Jeroboam took what God gave him. He says, okay, you're anointed, go and avenge, then rule my people. And he just spends his time elevating himself. He associates himself with God and with Elijah, with the Rechabites, trying to borrow off everybody else's credit. He shifts the blame to other people and says, hey, I didn't do it. That was on them. And all of these things he's doing is just to make himself look good, to build up his reputation, his persona in front of the people. And he doesn't actually ever go about serving God. He only serves God whenever it's something that he wants to do, kill people. He serves God when it suits him. He wants to go and wreak havoc on Ahab's family and on the worshipers of Baal because that appeals to him. I want to serve God in that way. But as far as actually trusting God, following him, following his precepts, living a godly life, leading the people in serving God, causing his family after him to serve God, now, he's not interested in that part. He just wants to go and make a bloodbath. That's the fun part for him, right? Kind of like a lot of Christians today. They're after God for health, wealth, and prosperity, but forget holiness, loving one another, caring for each other. Forget all that. I just want the blessings, right? And so that brings us to the end of Jehu. And so verse 35, Jehu slept with his fathers. They buried him in Samaria, and Jehoahaz, his son, reigned in his stead. And so you have Jehoahaz, and now they're going to be fighting between Israel and Judah again. Jehoahaz is going to be the king. And then we jump back to what's going on in Judah. And I'm not going to get into that this week. That'll be next week. But what I have already covered last week, because Jehu killed Ahaziah, the king of Israel, or king of Judah, who then ruled Judah? Athaliah. So Athaliah, for the first 6 years of Jehu's kingdom, Athaliah is ruling Judah. And so you've got the devil in Judah. You got Jehu in Israel, right? But Jehu is doing God's will, bringing vengeance on Ahab. But then in Judah, you have what? You've got Athaliah, right? But you also have something else. You have Jehoiada the priest. And so you've got Jehu ending lives, and you've got Jehoiada preserving a life. And so Jehoiada the priest is taking care of Joash, the next king in the Davidic line in Judah, until he's old enough to become king and to depose evil Athaliah, right? And we looked at that last week. But just think of the contrast. Jehu comes in, slaughtering everyone, while Athaliah is over here slaughtering everyone. And then you got Jehoiada the priest is coming in, rescuing the son, raising him up, protecting him, nurturing him, keeping away from all the madness that's going on within the monarchies. And Jehu thought that he was the one that had the zeal for the Lord. Jehu thought he was the one whose heart was right with God. And I would much rather have Jehoiada preserving the monarchy than Jehu wiping them out. Right? And it's just weird as you read through the Bible, you don't usually, you know, as we're ping-ponging back and forth between Judah and Israel, you don't pay that much attention to that, right? But that's what was going on at the same time. Jehoiada and Jehu. So, what do you think? That sums it up. It is an absolute mess. But it goes back to, forget when it was that we were talking about this, but whenever sin comes in, it makes a mess out of everything, right? And that's one reason heaven is going to be so great one of these days, is sin's going to be done away with, the mess is going to be over. But for right now, everything is a mess because of sin. And back then, because of the sin that was going on, everything was a mess. Anything else? Okay, let's go ahead and we don't have a time of prayer.